Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Morning, campers. Thank you for tuning in to The High-Low, hosted by me, Dolly Alderton, and her, Pandora Sykes. We are the pop culture and news podcast that envelops highbrow culture and lowbrow culture with the same all-encompassing warm embrace and a snog.
I've got a toffee in my mouth, so apologies if it sounds a bit congested. Here at The High-Low, we think it's important to never be ashamed to ask a stupid question when you don't know the answer. And we think that a keen interest in current affairs is not negated by a passion for watching
Jonathan Creek Series 1 on Netflix while eating nachos. Yes, that was a recent Saturday night with my flatmates, so sue me. So I'm going to hand over to my esteemed colleague to give you a little history on the high-low.
I love it when people go, so sue me. Do you mean nachos with cheese and sour cream and peppers? Because I think you just mean the tortilla chips, and that's both lame and erroneous.
Now that you bring my attention to it, I was talking about shrimp tacos, but for the purpose of streamlining the intro, I said nachos. But I'd also, while we're on the subject of shrimp tacos, I order them from Chook's, Muswell Hill, and they're the best fucking thing you can order on Deliveroo. And
I won't be able to get that though, because I don't live near.
They have loads of different branches. I'm shamelessly asking Chook's now, and I very rarely do this.
Chook's.
Please send me some free stuff.
Okay, interesting. Anyway, the High-Low is based on High-Low Media, invented by Tina Brown, the 80s Vanity Fair editor. It sums up my raison d'etre in life. Nothing is too low, nothing is too high. From chin hairs to Trumpian politics, moon cups to Brexit. We discuss it all here on Radio Watford.
Oh, Christ. You are too obsessed with love, actually, I think.
And this one's for all the lovers out there.
Right, enough of that, thank you. So, we've had a two-week break from
our last
episode.
Sorry, we love you, but it was lovely.
Breaks are always nice.
No, it was nice.
What were we up to? What
was
you?
We were on holiday. You were chilling in Chillington. I can't believe you went somewhere called Chillington. It's so gap year, right? Is that the main reason you went? Because it sounded ridiculous.
The nominative determinism.
What?
When a place is...
Oh, what it sounds like.
So like when a woman is called Mrs. Smelly and she smells...
Oh my God,
as is Chillington. We went to do some Chillington.
Is it really chilly?
It was very chilly. It was very, as in, we were very chilled out there. It was lovely. Although I went there with my best friend Farley for a few days. I was mainly going there to do some writing. She was prepping for a new job. But there were some frolics on the farm, as you saw on Instagram.
Oh my God, that duck.
I know.
Did you see I wrote, I'm so pleased you found me?
I know, it looked so much like you. I've always said Pandora looks like a baby duck or chick that's just been hatched and looks a little bit frazzled and bewildered. So that was nice, although I had a very sad realisation while I was away that I have become a real dickhead Londoner and I never wanted this day to come.
What, because you can't find a good flat white? That's my thing.
A little bit of that. Where's the Wi-Fi password sort of the minute you get in? But it was more, when we arrived, there was this, it was an Airbnb. It was a really good Airbnb. It was run by a really lovely couple. They've got quite a slow, relaxed pace of life down there. And when we arrived, the man was sort of big into the chit-chat. And it was like, and we hadn't unpacked our bags or anything. And he was like, what do you do in London? Asking a lot of questions. And then he was like, can I show you the map of the area? And then he took us in and showed us this big map.
That happens
on the
in
wall.
Hotels as well, then. It always drives me mad. No, I don't want a tour.
But I was a little bit like, I really hated myself for being a bit like, oh, shut up. I just want to go like unpack my stuff. It's like, what is wrong with just having a nice chit chat about the area with this man? It just made me realise that I'm so on a pace where it's like, I don't talk to anyone. I get my stuff done. And I don't really want
don't
to turn into
being,
a person like that.
I don't think that's being a Londoner. I think there's a thing when you travel that you need to just like come and be and get your equilibrium back. Like the first thing I always do wherever I am is I want to go to my room just for like 5 minutes and wash my face and go to the loo. I bet if you come back in an hour when you were
maybe
you know, having
I
a glass of wine
relaxed.
Then you'd have been
more chilling.
I don't know, people who don't live in London, so our solo listener in Kazakhstan and Botswana, let us know if you think this is just dolly or if you sometimes don't want a tour of Chillington.
So you've been travelling as well.
Yes, well, I wasn't meant to be. I was meant to be just in Essex at my parents' house, hitting loads of deadlines. My mum was absolutely gutted because I ended up going on a last-minute work trip to New York, which was great, but bloody exhausting. Norwegian Air is an absolute
It was very glam, I think, for you to just be in New York for... Well, I went there for 2 hours.
I went there for work. I was there for 2 days. I went there for work. I was sent out there to do an interview and then I had meetings. But because I was going so last minute, I did go with Norwegian Air because they're the only airline that don't
charge. Shittiest airline ever.
Absolute pits. Like, seriously, I can see why it's so cheap. So no tellies, which is obviously incredibly dull on an 8-hour flight.
I hate going to New York on Norwegian. I hate it.
Is that a thing or is that just an old plane? Because I heard someone muttering that it's just an old plane and that's why there were no
tellies. I think it's an old plane because, like, I've been on Norwegian and they do sometimes have screens.
TVs.
But they also, I told you about the incident with the blanket in 2013 or whatever.
Oh, I can't remember. Tell me. I had a blanket incident.
Where I went on the plane and I hadn't brought a jumper on with me. And it was so cold on the plane. So I asked them for a blanket. They said that they charged, it was $30 for a blanket. An acrylic blanket.
So I wasn't even offered that. So I took the red eye back. And I didn't realise that everyone else around me did, because they voluntarily booked a very cheap flight. So they realised, whereas, you know, I was there for work, so I had no idea about this. But all you want to do is sleep. Not only did they do incredibly antisocial stuff, like keep the lights on the whole time.
Yeah,
turn
they did that
the fucking
mine.
Lights on as soon as you get on the plane. Stop serving food. If people request food, fine. Rattling around 4 hours into the flight, 1 hour they turn the lights off. But not only that, you don't get blankets, eye masks, socks, anything like that. I was absolutely freezing. I asked them four times to turn down the aircon. Everyone around us asked them to turn down the aircon. Guy next to me ended up lending me his puffer jacket and I zipped myself completely up inside it like a sleeping bag.
Aww.
I don't know if his girlfriend thought it was weird or not, but at the end I was like, thank you, you've saved my life. I only slept for an hour and a half.
They are particularly shit.
I literally don't remember Friday. I had to come into town for a meeting and I walked the whole way there and back. I floated.
The main question I want to know is, did you have Butcher's Daughter pastrami sandwiches?
So I went to Butcher's Daughter, which I love. I've been there before. Did I tell you about Butcher's Daughter?
Yeah, you recommended me. And then when I went to New York, I had like every meal there.
I loved it. But breakfast is not so good, actually.
Oh, really?
I had avocado on toast, but it's avocado on bread. It's got to be toast.
God, it's got to be toast.
Their pastrami comes in sausage version, which is...
Ooh,
well,
not
when
good?
It's a bit much. When it's little pieces, you can fool yourself into thinking. So Butcher's Daughter, for all of you out there, is... a vegan restaurant, I think.
Yes, it's
only vegetarian vegan, so the cheese isn't even cheese.
But it tastes like cheese.
It tastes like cheese. And the pastrami is very, very good, but I had it in sausage form and it wasn't as good as when it's in bacon form. But I do love it there. It's gorgeous. And I was sitting next to a Victoria's Secret supermodel.
No way.
My friend Lara, who's a bit like you with popular culture, when we were leaving, I was like, do you know who we're sitting next to? And she goes, I thought I recognised that old man. And I was like, no. It's Romy Strigida, the Victoria's Secret angel, sitting next to us. Anyway, so that was New York. So what else has been happening over here?
So it's been a big old fortnight for news in the high-lows absence.
Yeah, there was a lot that I kept on thinking, oh, that's good for the high-lows. I suppose 2 weeks is a long time to accumulate stories from high and low. So starting with the small.
Can I just pause very quickly because I'm going to take my jumper off. I'm in workout gear right now, which is quite uncharacteristic.
Okay, it's fine. I can have a toffee.
This sports bra is killing me. I'll show you it later.
The floor is quite hot in here.
What a contraption it is.
Oh my God, your t-shirt's fucking hilarious. Your t-shirt is like those t-shirts that they always put on those American websites and it's like, love, peace, kale.
I know.
Dolly is wearing a t-shirt that says alcohol, caffeine, nicotine.
I'm going for a run after this.
Did you buy that?
And I like to make a point.
Did you buy it?
I bought it when I was like 18 and a dick and it wasn't meant to be.
What, because those are the things you love?
Yeah, it wasn't meant to be ironic and now I wear it when I'm working
out. It wasn't meant to be ironic?
No, it wasn't meant to be ironic. I was a dickhead, like, Pandora. I told you this.
Why does it say like blowjob at the bottom?
Well, one's actions can speak louder than words.
It's a busy few weeks for news. Who says stuff like that? I mean, the news is just the news. How can I say it's been a busy week for news? So starting with something low. The Hilo's Twitter has been abuzz this week with low things from me, like Botox for buttholes, apparently a thing.
What does it do? Does it clench
the
muscle?
Well, imagine that Botox, you know how Botox gets loads of wrinkles and the anus is a very wrinkly little thing.
Oh, that is
but
true.
Imagine,
you know, they can't smooth out the anus wrinkles. They can prevent more from accumulating.
God, you can bleach it, you can wax it, you can Botox it. What's left of it by the end? Just a scared little prune.
doesn't want to ever come out again after all of that, although it shouldn't ever be out technically anyway. Anyway, also, exciting news for millennials at least, Tamagotchis are back. This takes me right down memory lane. Mashable has reported that the Japanese toy maker Bandai have re-released first editions of their electronic pocket pet. It's only available in Japan, but thank God for the internet, because you can actually buy one from Amazon Japan for approximately £13. Anyway, such news takes me instantly back to the playground where my Tamagotchi, or Gotchi for short, was alternately pooing, crying, or threatening to die. They were so passive-aggressive, actually, just aggressive.
They were quite neurotic as well.
Always threatening to die. And I really remember being 8 years old and completely tyrannised by the monkey bars as my Gotchi withered and crumpled. Not unlike when my Furby used to keep me up all night. Did you ever have a Tamagotchi or a Furby or a Pog? I had like 400 Pogs. Loads. They were really democratic. Everyone could afford a Pog.
I had Pogs. I had two Furbies. I had a big Furby and a baby Furby. Yeah, I was obsessed.
What? But they were so expensive. I only got one because I went to F.A. Schwartz
America. I think I
asked
for one for my birthday and one for Christmas.
Menagerie of Furbies.
I would have had a menagerie of virtual pets. I had loads of Tamagotchis. I had hundreds of Beanie Babies, me and my brother. I was a kid growing up in the suburbs who was desperate to be like the Waltons.
Material things?
No. Who was desperate to like grow up in the countryside.
No, I love material things.
So I just wanted to be like around animals all the time. And obviously we couldn't do that in our house in Stanmore. So I just had loads and loads of virtual animals.
I had like 100 Beanie Babies. Actually, correction, I have 100 Beanie Babies because my mum told me that one day the special bears, if we kept their tag protectors on, she's obviously read something, that they were going to be worth loads of money on eBay. And it's a goddamn sham that I've believed for 20 years. I've still got all these Beanie
Babies.
Are they
not worth anything now?
Periodically, I look it up. So I looked up recently how much Halo was worth. And Halo was...
Is Halo the unicorn?
No, Halo's the bear with the Halo.
Duh. Oh, yeah, of course.
I've got loads of variations of it. And I looked it up and he was only on sale on eBay for $1.39. Well, actually, to be accurate, he was also on sale for $150, but none of them were selling.
Have you ever seen that photo of a couple separating their Beanie Baby collection in 1999
when they get divorced
on the floor of a divorce court? It's so good.
We're going to tweet that. Dolly's going to find it and we're going to tweet that.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Was it your parents? No. I've got like 100 of them. I'm going to keep hold of them for my children because I don't know what the fuck
do
else
you know
to
do. Do
you
know what I used to do with mine, which is particularly losery, is I used to buy the plastic display cases for all of them.
Yes, I think I had one. God, I was completely governed by what America did, hence the fact I had tag protectors.
Yeah, I had tag protectors, yeah.
Wow, I really think that we were the age where kind of that Americanization, those American toys were just huge for us. Because I remember also going to my friend Siobhan's house to watch Nickelodeon.
Oh, yeah, that Sister, was Sister, Boy Meets
Hardly
World.
Anyone had Sky. We didn't get Sky until I was about 15. Only one girl, only Siobhan had Sky. And I used to go and I used to watch whatever the Olsen twins were called.
Two of a Kind.
Yeah, I mean, all those programmes were, oh my God,
me and
amazing.
My flatmate regularly reminisce on those
but
programmes
now,
that
now
we were obsessed
with. But now you just take them for
advantage. All I did from take them for the years of 99 to 2004 is just watch Nickelodeon. That's all I did.
Vegetate. And play with your Beanie Babies.
Play my Beanie Babies, eat ready meals and watch Nickelodeon.
Ready meals as well. My God, I remember my mum used to make me pizza when I used to watch Home and Away. Fucking hell. Being age 10 was like amazing if you were me or you and really spoiled.
You couldn't pay me to go back there.
Right.
Anyway.
I was quite lonely. I just read a lot of Ina Blyton, but...
Oh, awful.
Really?
I hated being a teenager, yeah.
10, Dolly?
No, but that whole period of just sitting in front of
Nickelodeon
and eating.
I love the way that I was
age
10 with Beanie Babies watching Nickelodeon and Dolly's like, God, being 17 was dreadful.
God, being 19 was rough.
Anyway, back to the Tamagotchis. I tweeted, well, the Hilo tweeted. It's so useful having an autonomous Twitter handle. And then I retweeted it for double exposure that I'd be happy to nurture a Tamagotchi for a week to see if 30-year-old Pandora is any better at keeping one alive than 8-year-old Pandora. Great bit of journalism, I thought that would be. It doesn't bode well for parenthood if I'm no better at keeping it alive than when I was 8. But, you know, if anyone's keen, good bit of journalism.
I think that definitely could get commissioned. Get me some free shrimp tacos. Get Pandora a commission about Tamagotchis.
I'd like both.
My friend Sabrina thinks that the modern adult version of Tamagotchis is talking to a man you haven't met from a dating app for weeks on end, especially if it goes into sexting, and when you have to kind of keep going back every day, kind of messaging 5 times a day, it's a bit like keeping
it
alive.
No, because the man's not going to die, whereas the Tamagotchi had you're its only reason for living, and I'm hoping that...
Well,
not,
for many men, that's
I was gonna
their,
say,
I am
hoping,
their only reason for
I'm
living.
I'm hoping that not every man your friend Sabrina's talking to Also this week, fellow members of girl gangs will be appalled and shocked and saddened as I am to read that apparently period syncing is not a thing.
Girl gangs. Anyway, carry on.
As in big groups of all female friends.
Do yours wear t-shirts that say alcohol, caffeine and nicotine?
No, just me.
It's the best t-shirt I've ever fucking seen.
The Guardian reports that a giant study of women's...
A giant study?
I know. I've copy and pasted that from the piece. That's so bizarre.
A giant study. I love that. It's so scientific.
Which I know.
A humongous research project.
A giant study of women's periods carried out by period tracking app Clue in partnership with the University of Oxford has found it's very unlikely that cycle syncing is a real phenomenon. Researchers surveyed 1,500 women, then narrowed their group into 360 pairs of women. They analysed three consecutive cycles in each pair and found that the majority of women...
Anyway, so they didn't think it was a thing.
Yeah, but I think that where they've gone wrong there is that you can't... The whole point of syncing is it's not just like any old woman that you find on the street. It has
any
to
old
be...
Bint. It has to be your period pal.
It has to be someone that you're physically and emotionally close with. If you just put me with a woman in Primark now for 3 months, our periods
I
wouldn't
could in
sync.
That t-shirt. Is it from Primark?
Oh my God, you're being such a bitch about the t-shirt. Can you just get everything out that you need to say about it and then
no,
we can move on?
No, because I haven't thought of it all now. It will keep coming back to me. This is quite funny because I remember I was at a boarding school and we were really obsessed with that because obviously if you're going to sink, you're probably going to sink at boarding school because you're all eating the same thing, canteen food. Whereas presumably now when you say you sink with your flatmates... I don't believe that because you can't all be eating exactly the same thing. And if you are, that
you
sounds
eat,
really
no,
virgin
but it's
suicide.
Nothing to do with eating.
Yes, it is. It's exactly the same living conditions. It's how many variables.
But that's so weird because, she won't mind me saying it, me and Sophie Wilkinson are synced as well. And we have entirely different, we live in different flats, different parts of London, and have entirely different
lives. Yeah, but Dorothy, I've told you this before. It's just the probability that your period will overlap with someone else's.
No, because why am I synced with Farley as well? Farley and I aren't in the same flat. I've always been synced with my flatmates.
What, every single month? Exactly the same time you're
within about 2 days, yeah.
Well, listen, this giant study disagrees with you.
I've always really liked this kind of magical, powerful mysticism of syncing, particularly when periods are so fucking grim.
I think we'll have to... Sorry, I'm still eating sweets. I'm on my seventh and last sweet, though.
You still are living that Nickelodeon life, by the way.
The big few stories are broken. Firstly, Edward Enerful has been announced as new editor-in-chief of British Vogue. So that might not seem like a big deal to anyone outside of the fashion industry or the media industry. Actually, it is. So Alexandra Schulman left after a quarter century of editing Vogue and all eyes were on who would be next. There was a lot of talk of who it was going to be, lots of names thrown up. The appointment of Edward, who prior to this was the fashion and creative director at W Magazine, hugely powerful magazine in the States. Side note, he became fashion director of ID aged 18.
Oh, I hate those stories.
18!
I mean, anyway, well done, but...
Anyway, it's meaningful not only because Edward is a man, obviously, and men never helm women's glossies, but secondly, he is black. So a black man being at the helm of British Vogue is not unlike a black man being in the White House, hello, Obama, but on a micro scale. So within the fashion industry, which obviously there's a lot of criticism rightfully dealt its way, I really hope that this will be a massive step for progression, for diversity. The European press is actually far worse than the US when it comes to diversity. When I was in New York, I bought $90 worth of magazines. Magazines are fucking expensive out there, by the way. Anyway, like the New Yorker's $8.50. Mm. So I bought $90 of magazines over about 4 different days. I didn't do the hit in one. And I really noticed the difference in the skin colours of not just the models, but who they featured as well. So Allure, for example, big magazine in the States, had 3 black models on its cover at the same time. And aside from Vogue Italia's all black issue in, I think, 2008, which funnily enough, Edward was behind, I can't think of a time when I've seen this in Europe. So I think it will be a really seismic shift for popular culture.
I didn't know who he was before this, but as you say, it seems like a historic choice, and everything I've read, it sounds like he is the perfect man for the job. Although I must say, I am disappointed the title of British Vogue editor didn't fall on George Osborne or another random member of the Tory government, as many probably predicted.
Would have been less surprising to see you as the editor of Vogue, Dolly, than some of the appointments that's happened this year. Also, we can't not mention the Pepsi advert.
I was trying to see how long ago.
I know, I refuse
it.
To let you avoid that storm. Pepsi last week unveiled their new global advert starring Kendall Jenner, for which they probably paid her like £15 million.
How much do you think they actually would have paid her?
I was going to ask you that with your knowledge of kind of TV and rights and stuff. I would have thought multiple millions. I don't know what you
think. I think it would have been very lucrative because famously, Pepsi ads are, when you think back to even when the Spice Girls did it, it's always been a slight trope that if you do a Pepsi ad, it means you've really hit the big time, you've really kind of sold out.
Well, I wouldn't say sold out, but I agree with hit the big time.
It's, well, you capitalised at the peak of your...
Because it's a household name. It's those few brands like Coca-Cola, Pepsi. I remember I was interviewing someone recently and I asked them what their dream brand to collaborate with, and they said McDonald's. Everyone's heard of McDonald's. Oh, you know, you'd feel like you'd really broken popular culture. I mean, Cindy Crawford did one in 1992, which is just... Did you get my message saying, watch Cindy Crawford?
I haven't seen it yet. She's so hot, though. She's one of my favourite models, Cindy
Crawford. Phenomenal. So it's a huge deal. So anyway, massive brand alignment with Kendall. They'll have spent loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of money on it. But essentially, there's a riot and everyone's really bummed out until Kendall takes off her blonde wig and changes out of a sparkly dress. No idea. Apparently, you must always take off your blonde hair to address a riot. And she gives the policeman a Pepsi and... peace and love and unity are restored.
The best, and I must say, most good-humoured tweet in response to it came from Bernice King, who's the youngest child of Martin Luther King, who wrote, if only Daddy had known about the power of Pepsi.
That's amazing.
It's really funny. And then following that, she wrote on the subject quite seriously in the Huffington Post and stated that the advert contributed to the notion that there is a fairy tale light way to ease conflicts that have existed in this nation for hundreds of years.
So I don't always agree with the idea that all of those things always trivialise conflict, because otherwise no movie, essentially, like very few movies would ever get made. But the main problem with this, obviously, is not... I don't think necessarily the kind of fairy tale aspect of it, because I think that just exists in most adverts and films. But I think it's the appropriation, the commodification of the race riots. Pepsi have said that on no account did they mean this to be the case. Obviously, it does look like sort of tokenism. You've got one woman wearing a headscarf and you've got Kendall being the kind of white power ranger to come in and make everything better. But they said they wanted to take a generic riot, kind of generic unrest, and show that politics can be solved by love and unity. Unfortunately...
And a can of Pepsi.
Unfortunately, you just have to think outside those parameters now. You have to think exactly about who you're putting on screen and why you're putting on screen and what that's going to convey.
Yeah, I mean, even if I did believe their intentions were noble and honest, which I don't, I do think it's as well like a bit late in the day to be making a statement like this. I think the timing of it shows they have been entirely exploitative in their homogenisation and commercialisation of a very, very serious thing to sell a fucking fizzy drink.
There's been some really interesting op-eds on it. The New York magazine's The Cut ran an interesting piece where they spoke to all these ad execs being like, how did this happen? How did this Pepsi advert actually get made? How did it get signed off by however many people? And what is interesting is that there was no outside agency. It was only Pepsi's agency. They didn't bring in any outside presence. And so a lot of the ad execs have said, you know, the moment someone from a different agency came in, they would have noticed this because you bring this fresh perspective.
How could you not?
So that's perhaps why it got so escalated to this point, because they weren't consulting with people outside of Pepsi. That's A. The other interesting thing that I read was a staff writer at Man Repeller called Hayley, who just writes really, really interesting op-eds. She got trounced for a piece she wrote, and she very duly replied to the comments saying, I'm listening and I'm learning and, you know, thank you. And she kind of did a parody of it by saying that Kendall had to take off her blonde wig and that it was all about kind of fetishizing pretty women and the misogyny of it. But she obviously got a lot of abuse because she didn't mention race, which was a main factor. She also assumed, though, which I think was interesting, which I would have done, that most of the people at the agency were male. Interestingly, most of the people at Pepsi's ad agency are women. The first thing you would think to is, oh, it must be like an old white man. But actually...
I would be interested to see how many white people were there.
I'm interested that there were that many women.
I wouldn't assume it was either a female or a male team that would be behind that.
From one sketchy image to another brilliant one, which is Safia Khan smiling up at a furious member of the EDL, which is obviously an image that went viral over, I think it was Sunday or Monday.
It's a truly inspiring photo, and as Pandora tweeted yesterday, it proves that Instagram can be so much more than just photos of lattes and peonies, guilty as charged.
I think I wrote cappuccinos, but I didn't have enough letters. Fucked with me, it's 140 characters.
So the photo shows an EDL protester, Ian Crossland, staring into the eyes of the young woman who's looking back at him with her hands in her pockets, and she's smiling and she's kind of looking at him unfazed, and a police officer appears to be restraining him. The woman pictured has been identified as Safia Khan, who's from Birmingham. Her family has links to Bosnia and Pakistan. She said the picture was taken when she stepped in to defend a woman wearing a hijab who had been surrounded by a group of the protesters after she called them racists. The MP, Jess Phillips, tweeted the photo and said, who looks like they have power here, the real Brummie on the left or the EDL who migrated for the day to our city and failed to assimilate. Her tweet had been shared and liked nearly 18,000 times by Sunday evening. So it's a hugely inspiring photo, not only for the young woman's bravery, but also I think it shows the power of calm and peace when faced with such irrational, disgusting, mad hatred. As Jess Phillips said, all that photo does is show very clearly who the same party is. And there are lots of other details of how Birmingham rallied together, because Birmingham is a wonderfully diverse and multicultural city. And there were lots of lovely details on how they made a stand against this EDL protest. The Birmingham Central Mosque held a Best of British party, complete with Union Jack, bunting, tea. A local MP, Liam Burns, said that the event that was in the mosque celebrated the quiet miracle of a normal life and the things that we love most about our city and our country.
So Suzanne Moore, a Guardian journalist, wrote a piece on the power of the image. So she wrote, Khan's small act of resistance becomes larger, so welcome, so cheering, and so monumentally cool. Rosa Parks said, you must never be fearful about what you're doing when it is right. This is the joy of Khan's fearlessness. Hands in her pockets, deeply unbothered by angry, ranting men. Her smile has spread far and wide because it is an image of undeniable strength and power. Glorious. It's also just really nice to see a woman just completely unfazed by disruption. I think, you know, all too easily we erupt in the face of adversity, and I like that
or recoil,
and I like that she's doing neither.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So, on to books. The High-Low have been busy reading over the last couple of weeks, and we've got some very good book recommendations for you.
So Dolly very kindly bought me the journalist Ariel Levy's book, The Rules Do Not Apply, and I read it last week. So she's a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, whose work I very much enjoy and makes me wish every day that I could be a long-form journalist. Again, can you commission me for that before the Tamagotchi piece? Because I don't know if I could do a long-form piece on Tamagotchis. So Ariel wrote about the stillbirth of her baby and the breakdown of her marriage with her wife.
Farley actually read it when we were away in Devon. She read it in about two sittings because I've been recommending it so much.
God, two long sittings.
Yeah. I found it a deeply moving read, as I've said before. I thought it covered what it means to kind of have it all as a woman in a very frank, very fresh way.
It's actually something I found in Dawn O'Porter's new book. They're very, very different reads, but hers is a really brave and interesting and innovative look at all the different pulls on women and the different ways of making a woman feel shamed. But yeah, on Ariel's book, had a lot of pickup. She's a very well-known writer. So Hadley Freeman, a brilliant writer who's a friend of hers, did a great piece on it, as did the New York Times. I enjoyed the book, although I did find the prose a little sparse. I think I prefer her long-form stories in terms of writing, but in terms of how affecting it is, this book is off the charts. It's one of the bravest and most affecting things I've read, which is perhaps the mark of a really successful book rather than, say, lyrical prose. I don't know, I'm always interested in the process of writing, and what makes a great book is sometimes it's not that the writing is the best thing you've ever read, it's the weight of the pages, and I don't mean the like literal weight of the page.
I'm surprised. I really loved the prose, and I think she painted really beautiful scenes and pictures with her prose, although I suppose it was quite clipped in parts, and both you and I are suckers for big, flowery, tarty prose, elaborate prose.
Yeah, I did feel it was quite sparse, but you know, that's a style choice. But either way, I do disagree wholesale with the entirely mad piece in the New Republic, which I think is a US website.
I hadn't come across it before.
A piece by Charlotte Shane, which basically said, I think the title was Shut Up and Get Over Your White Privilege, something like that. It had white privilege in the title, and the thrust of the piece was, so you had a dead baby, get over it, everyone like has dead babies sometimes, and by the way, shut up because you're white. And I understand about checking your white privilege, but this was essentially a call for silence, which seemed redundant, and the fact that it's fucking woman that wrote that piece, it's excellent to see a woman telling another woman to be silenced in the face of her own experience, isn't it?
Yeah, I found that a really hard pill to swallow, that piece, because as you say, privilege, what it does and what it doesn't entitle you to do or say is a very complex thing that I'm constantly trying to re-examine and assess. But so I keep returning to this line in Transparent on the topic of privilege, where a character says your pain and your privilege are two very different things. I think that does apply here. I think Ariel Levy experiencing the death of a premature birth is a human experience entirely separate from whatever privilege she's born with or has accumulated. And I don't think that she's hooking that experience onto a wider political thing. I think she's just telling a very painful story in a very vulnerable and beautiful way. And actually, that article, Panda, does play into your theory that you have that women perpetuate the worst crimes on each other.
Yeah, well, not necessarily the worst, obviously, but the micro issues that sort of seep into your everyday and quite a damaging rhetoric. Yes, I mean, I was watching Made in Chelsea last night. It was quite funny watching it. My husband was like, they're all being so defeatist this episode. I was like, oh dear, don't worry too much. But I was watching Made in Chelsea last night and there was one girl who was heartbroken because her boyfriend, they'd broken up and he fancied someone else. And this other girl goes to her, don't worry, you're so much prettier than her. And another person was like, yeah, you're so much prettier. And I thought, it's that kind of redundant thinking. It's that I used to do it. Everyone used to do it in the playground. You know, if you liked someone and they fancied someone else, or there was a girl that wasn't very nice, and everyone would go, don't worry, you're much prettier than her. It's that assessment of women's looks, which, yes, I do feel is much more perpetuated by women on women. So one woman telling another woman that she's a big fat sissy for complaining about the breakdown of her marriage and the loss of her baby, you know, that's like 48 steps back for feminism. And I was actually listening to a podcast this morning, one of the brilliant Guilty Feminist podcasts, and there was a woman saying that her friends like to call themselves womanists instead of feminists, as feminism doesn't include enough female positivity. And I can't say I agree with that term. It reminds me of humanists as well, though each to their own, whatever you want to call yourself. But I do think the fact that women are searching for other terms rather than feminism suggests that women are having a hard time not criticising the female experience of others.
Friend of the high-low, Daisy Buchanan, has a book out this week called How to Be a Grown-Up, which Panda and I were lucky enough to read advanced copies of, and I enjoyed so much. I'm proudly quoted on the back saying how brilliant it is.
I'm not, but that's fine. Don't worry about it, Daisy.
It's a very funny, deeply personal, very bold book, which is part memoir, part sort of handbook.
Basically, about to say handbag.
Part handbag.
It's multi-purpose.
It has got a beautiful cover, but the words inside are even better. And it's kind of exploring how to be a happier, healthier, calmer, better adult. But, you know, you can read it at any age. I found it very, very useful at the age of 28. I would have loved to have read it when I was younger as well. I think my mum would love it as well. It covers how to be sad, how to be healthy in body and mind, how to have sex. It covers really big stuff. And then it covers more kind of trivial stuff like how to wash your hair, which I found very useful. And it's a mixture of personal anecdotes from Daisy's life, as well as take home tips and advice and stories from other people her age.
Is that your stomach?
That was my stomach, yeah.
You should have eaten
one of your many Mauams.
God, I was 7 sweets. Always doing the studio. Well done, Daisy. We look forward to toasting you at your book launch tomorrow.
I'd also like to talk about another book that I read this weekend that's really, really stuck with me. I read it in about 4 hours flat. I took it to Hampstead Heath on the gloriously hot Sunday we had when I was recovering from a wedding hangover. And then I finished it in bed yesterday and I felt so winded and bereft afterwards. I kind of just sat on the edge of my bed, not quite knowing what to do with myself. It's called The Wild Other by Clover Stroud. And it's a memoir on grief, wildness, family, sex, freedom, the kind of the darkness within us. The narrative that pulls it through is about a very, very tragic riding accident that happens to her mother when she's 16, and she kind of loses her mother in one sense, and then she doesn't lose her mother in another sense, so she can't kind of mourn it. And yeah, it's very raw, very honest, very poignant, very human, quite sexy actually, and I loved it. I can't remember the last time that I cried as much into the pages of a book. I think I was a teenager, but anyway, go buy it, it's brilliant.
I'm actually also currently reading, I'm multiple dating when it comes to books. I'm currently reading a book called Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, or Why I'm Not Talking to White People About Race Anymore. Sorry, I can't remember which way that goes around. And it's by Rennie Edo Lodge, who I became aware of recently. She wrote a great piece for British Vogue online about how all the furore over Emma Watson was sort of like, she had some cleavage out on like a magazine cover. She was wearing something Burberry and she had some cleavage out, like Vanity Fair or something. She got quite a lot of shit. And Rennie was saying she only got shit because it's actually very much to do with race. Like, people think that Emma Watson's this kind of white virginal person, so when she gets her chest out, it's like, oh my God. Whereas she's the example of like Nicki Minaj, where it's sort of like expected and there's never that dichotomy because they're never the angel to fall in the first place. Anyway, it's a brilliant piece. So I'm reading this book. It's a very unapologetic title. It's not out yet. It's a proof copy. Sure to Generate Criticism. It's an interesting read thus far. I will keep you posted. And I've also been obsessed with Big Little Lies as well, like I think most telly-watching individuals right now.
I haven't managed to watch it yet. I have tried every single avenue and I cannot watch it.
It's because you have Sky, do you?
No.
So how much can I give away on this?
Well, I think just say spoiler alert and then you're covered. Well, skip forward 15 seconds.
Sort of spoiler alert. Well, there are some... So essentially... Okay, I won't give away anything, but what I will say is that there are some really brilliant pieces that have been written on it. I think it's very much captured people's attention. Reese Witherspoon produced it, and she has said, and the guy that wrote Ally McBeal wrote it, and she has said that she was used to being billed at the top of a film in order to get financing, you know, so everyone would be like, oh, we've got Reese Witherspoon attached to this, it would get money. And she was never amongst women of her calibre. They were always split up on different films. And she wanted to bring together all these really strong, powerful women in Hollywood together to show that, you know, they can do this thing together. So it's kind of quite a feminist project. It's so cleverly and brilliantly done, and it really encapsulated my belief that popular culture absolutely does not mean that it is crappy any much as it insinuates that something academic should have to be highfalutin. There was Eva Wiseman wrote something for The Observer magazine on Sunday, and she essentially said how trashy TV can actually be really powerful. And I agree with the powerful bit, but I disagree with the fact that it's trashy. It's not trashy at all. It's so clever. And Emily Nussbaum, I don't know how to pronounce her name, but she is a TV critic for The New Yorker, and I love her writing. I read everything, even if I haven't watched the TV programme. She wrote a great piece called The Surprising Generosity of Big Little Lies. And you'd be very interested, Dolly, as someone who's also has worked in telly before, about the kind of character arcs. And she had lots of interesting thoughts on it. Anyway, I've read the book without realising. I forgot I'd read the book, and then I bought it again. And I was reading it, and I was like, I've definitely read this. It's actually set in Australia, but the series is set up the west coast of America. Anyway, I didn't love the book, but I love the series, and I think you will really enjoy it, Dolly.
I know, I've just got to wait. I think I'm going to have to wait until I can buy it on DVD.
So Dolly will watch it in 2021.
On to Barry Manilow. Last week, the much-loved American singer Barry Manilow came out as gay at the grand old age of 73. He's famous for hits such as Mandy and Copacabana. For our Generation Z and Generation Y listeners, of which we anticipate there may be a few, if you don't know who he is, we're going to jog your memory with this little soupçon. Who could ask for more at the Copacabana? The hottest spot north. The Guardian reported that he said publicly that he was gay after keeping his sexuality secret for decades for fear of disappointing his fans. The music veteran also confirmed that he's been in a relationship with a man for 39 years.
That's quite a long time to keep a secret.
It's the first time he's spoken openly about his sexuality. Barry Manilow married Gary Keefe at their home in Palm Springs in 2014, but never publicly confirmed the news. He told People magazine, "I'm so private, I always have been."
He went on to say that he met Gary Keefe, a TV executive, in 1978. I knew that was it. I was one of the lucky ones. I was pretty lonely before that.
The question is, do celebrities owe it to us to be transparent about their sexuality? Should Barry Manilow have come out earlier than he did? What do you make of this Pandora?
It's the tussle between us, I think, the public, thinking that we own the celebrity body because their celebrity is built on our literal sport. And the obvious kind of mental issue that if you distill yourself too much to millions of people you don't know, what's left of yourself? So private self versus public self. Sexuality is a really difficult one because it's not always cut and dried. But there is an interesting piece on the Daily Beast titled "Why Did It Take Barry Manilow So Long to Come Out?" And unlike a lot of online articles, there's a good amount of facts and research in there. So they've noted that according to the latest Gallup numbers, only 1.4% of people born between 1913 and 1945 identify as LGBT.
That's interesting.
So for millennials, it's 7.3%. So, you know, that's a massive rise from 1.4% to 7.3%. What those numbers reveal is that, you know, younger people are more comfortable than their older counterparts with the idea of sharing what some might consider private information on surveys. So it's not that they're saying, oh, there's way more gay people now. It's that they just wouldn't have entered, they wouldn't have entered that information into the public conscious. So tellingly, you know, Barry Manilow said, "I'm so private, I always have been." Differences in social climate are another possible contributor. contributor. So Gallup also said it's likely that millennials are the first generation in the US to grow up in an environment where social acceptance of the LGBT community is marked. If you came of age in the 1950s, by contrast, you wouldn't feel so confident about coming out. I mean, I think it's so much easier for millennials in many aspects. Coming out, I imagine to be one of them. I obviously haven't had that experience, so I can't say either way. But Kristen Stewart did an interview recently and she was like, I'm so gay, and roared with laughter. The way they wrote it was really lovely. It was great to see her this comfortable, as obviously she had a shit time of media scrutiny when she dated Robert Pattinson and then got sort of busted having an affair with Rupert Sanders. But I do wonder if that's quite a new thing, being able to be like, you know, I would not have expected that necessarily from Kristen Stewart. I'm glad that she could do that.
On one hand, I think the man is totally entitled to his privacy and, you know, he should feel free to be with whoever he wants and for his love life and not be a political statement. And I also understand as well that it is about selling records, particularly if you're singing love songs and the majority of people are heterosexual. Therefore, maybe the notion is that you should cater to that market. And, you know, that was the whole thing with George Michael. While everyone around him knew, he was close to him, knew that he was gay, none of his fans knew. And if you talk to any woman who was a big fan of his as a teenager growing up in the 80s, it was genuine heartbreak when he came out, because you kind of invest into the fantasy of him singing those songs to you. And I get it as well. I had the same thing with Will Young, and I stopped buying Will Young records the minute he came out, because for me that fantasy was shattered. Obviously, as you get older, I'm not a total dick and I now love listening to good music no matter who wrote it or who it was intended for. Love is love, desire is desire, it's a universal thing. But I do understand that slightly more cynical thought process for selling records.
Yeah, I think it's easier for singers because of that slight, you know, a lot of stage presence is a very kind of camp theatrical experience. But certainly, you know, we both know of a lot of actors that are rumoured to be gay who will never, ever come out, I doubt. I doubt it will ever emerge in their lifetime. And I think it's deeply sad, but it is, I'm sure, the result of the fact that Hollywood is very, very conservative in some ways. And if you think, well, those films go out all over the globe, the Bible Belt, it's just not an accepted thing to have a gay A-list actor. If you try to name some,
you can't.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, as you know, I consistently feel empathy for celebrities. I weep sometimes when they get divorced. But, you know, celebrities aren't snowflakes. They aren't made up of one woman or one man. There's a roaring PR machine back there. And as, you know, journalists, you hear of a lot that's gone on sort of beneath the surface that, you know, no one would ever print. But certain celebrities are not who you think you are. And I do kind of think now that there is this massive drive on authenticity and it's become incredibly important to find truth in a post-truth world. And I do think that celebrities should think a little bit more about who they are and what they're putting out, because they are so influential. And I think we are in a different time now than when there was just that completely mysterious, enigmatic celebrity. The amount as well that they're all sort of earning to be in these positions, I think, as fans, you should demand a certain truth. Yes.
Yeah, and I think another
part... But, you know, this is... I'm not in that position, am I?
Well, that's it, because it's another... I'm in two minds about it, because another part of me thinks I'm speaking from a place of immense privilege, because I don't really care if a singer publicly comes out as gay or not, because my people, I, heterosexual women, are represented everywhere. Heterosexual love stories are everywhere, in songs, in films, in stories, in fairy tales. Mm. I don't need to see my story represented anywhere to support me or inspire me or make me feel less alone.
So you think it's good actually for their fans to see that?
I do. I can understand why the gay community might take offence or feel sad or disappointed in celebrities not using their platform to be honest about their sexuality, because what the implication therefore is that their sexuality is something to be ashamed of.
Well, celebrities often say, you know, I didn't ask to be a role model, but unfortunately when you get to a certain amount of famosity, not sure that's a word, and you've got a certain amount of millions in the bank, unfortunately you are, you know. I found it actually agonising to see how much shit Taylor Swift got for not explaining why she didn't go to the women's marches. But also, perhaps her fans were right. Perhaps she did owe them a tweet, as someone who has very much harnessed the power of feminism and girl power and her squad, some like you say for commodification purposes. You know, if you borrow from those tenets, then you sort of have to give back. But I know that we were talking earlier about how some people you were saying that got a bit annoyed with Jessie J, who sort of reneged on her gayness, for want of a better word, and said it
yeah,
was
she
a...
came out as bisexual and then sort of took it back and said it was a phase.
Yeah, and I think actually she shouldn't be in trouble for that because, I mean, at least give her due, she was honest. Sexuality is fluid. So she was being honest about her experience at any given time. And I don't think you can, I don't think you can tell someone off for changing their mind. You know, she never lied, and life is, after all, made up of phases. You can be many different people. You personally can be many different people, and you can love many different people in one lifetime. Not that I've been particularly different between my phases. I'm boringly consistent. But I don't like the idea that you shouldn't ever discuss anything in the public forum unless you're 100% sure, because it leaves no room for error and a lot of pressure, I think, on young celebrities and, apart from anything else, young women.
I completely agree. I think the more cynical commentators were saying that it was very handy for her that she could
take... it was a tool.
Well, I think they felt like, because she's kind of quite highly sexualized, that maybe if she took the bisexuality back, then maybe she'd be more appealing to both heterosexual male audience, and also she'd be less alienating for young, straight teenage girls. So that was what more cynical people were saying, that it seems like she took back what was an authentic coming out because she wanted to sell more records. That's what cynics said.
Interesting. Anyway, on to the emails. Do tweet us if you've got any thoughts, by the way, about anything we've discussed today. As ever, it's been a mixed bag.
So our first email we have is actually in reference to another email that we read out a couple of weeks ago. The email's from a girl called Penny. She says, "Hello, thank you for your lovely podcast. I wanted to point the 23-year-old Never Been Kissed Australian
friends." Oh my God, yes, they really stayed with us, those gals.
"Yeah, from last week's podcast, in the direction of Rachel Hills's new book and upcoming play, The Sex Myth. As per the following lifted directly from the website, it's not them, it's societal norms. For years, Rachel harboured feelings of difference and defect when she considered the contrast between her own sex life and the ones portrayed in the glossy magazines she wrote for. When she realised that she was not alone in feeling this way, Rachel began her work on The Sex Myth, setting out to understand why sex was a matter of profound anxiety for so many people and where those feelings came from." So she's also done a TED Talk. So Penny's just giving those
really
girls
nice.
Some advice, and that's lovely.
That.
Thanks
I mean,
very much,
I'm
Penny.
Riveted by the narrative and society around sex, and also the fact that, if you think about it, even amongst, you know, your friends, you might talk about sex. Of everything you know about your friends, you're probably likely to know the least about their sex life. And it's such a massive, I don't know, part of your
life.
Yeah, it's a very interesting one. "Dear Dolly and Pandora, I love listening to your podcast on Wednesday afternoons at university. Along with the high-low, I'm obsessed with desert island discs." Us too. Dolly got me into that. "So my question is, what would both of your desert island disc choices be? Music, books and luxuries. And what do you hope that Kirsty would say to you in her eulogy-like introduction? And would you like her to invite you separately or like Anne and Deck as a pair?" I can say, absolutely instantly that Dolly would want to come on her own and she would want that to be the longest episode that Kirsty had ever recorded.
Well, I suppose they could easily do two episodes for me, couldn't they, Pandora? one for me and you.
What would yours be, Dolly?
I don't think we should say our music choices because we're going to jinx it, Panda, because you and I are going to make it into those hallowed BBC halls.
Okay, well, maybe name one of your favourite songs and then a few other things that you love in life.
One of my favourite songs would be Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones, and then I would take a bed like Jarvis Cocker, I think, as my luxury item.
I thought you'd take something that's like smelly. You love your sort of smelly bits.
Yeah, maybe a bath and a lovely bath oil.
A whole bath.
Yeah, you can be given a whole bath and a bath oil. Who did she give that to recently? Emma Bridgewater. What would your luxury item be?
Well, my song, if I was going to choose a song, would obviously be "And With a Swing." She started to strip.
I thought you were going to say "Signed, Sealed, Delivered" there, your wedding song.
No, do you know what? I absolutely love "Love Really Hurts Without You" by Billy Ocean. I've always been obsessed with da, 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 da. It makes me feel really, really happy, even though it's like a really sad song.
I love
which is why
song.
My husband wouldn't let us have it as a wedding dance because it was all about love hurting. Book, I would probably take, I just find, it always stays with me actually, and I was going to bring it in for Dolly to read because I'm not sure she's read it and I was too worried I wouldn't get it back. That's how much I love it. Called "The Opposite of Loneliness," which is a book of short stories.
I love that book.
By Marina Keegan. It is particularly affecting, I find, because Marina was a Yale graduate who died aged 22, 2 days after she graduated. She was very famous for her writing. At Yale, she was very well known for her writing and her slam poetry. So I love her short stories, but it is the story around them that kind of forever will linger
in my mind. Other things I love. What would I want to take in?
You're only allowed one luxury item.
My cat.
No, you're not allowed a cat.
How do you know?
Because I've listened to 3 million episodes.
Okay, what about if I turn her into a bath?
Turn her into a bath? What does that mean?
Then I can take her. How? Because you said I'm allowed a bath.
Cat, oh, I don't even want to think how you'd turn your cat into a
bath. Ossify her and cat bath shape her. Okay, anyway, last question.
Last question is...
Hi, Dolly and Pandora. I'm absolutely loving the High-Low show. I like reading the compliment.
You always do and I don't because...
In its new incarnation, I listen to it every week without fail and it makes me both laugh and think pretty hard about current issues. It's my favourite podcast by far, so
Dolly.
Thank you very much for making it. Oh, thank you very much, Skint Londoner. So... Her question is, as two London-dwelling ladies, I wonder if you have any advice on budgeting in the big and expensive city.
Oh,
I just moved to London, but I'm not earning very much, and a lot of my money is going on rent. However, my friends in the city are all on more money than me, and I want to enjoy going out and exploring my new home with them, going to restaurants, events, exhibitions, etc., etc. Thanks, a very skint Londoner.
Oh, I feel for you, because obviously it's incredibly expensive living in a city, particularly London. I would say, particularly coming into the spring and summer, we are really lucky in London. There's a lot you can do with not very much money. For starters, you can nurse a Coca-Cola in a pub garden or in a pub full stop. I'd say 4 hours. You could probably eke 4 hours out of it. Cannot do that in New York, let me tell you that for free.
No, you can't.
A lot of galleries are free. So the Saatchi Gallery, which is one of my favourites. It's got an exhibition on the selfie at the moment. That is free. So it's worth checking out all those places that are free. You can go to Dolly's beloved Hampstead Heath. That's free. Walk in Hyde Park. All those kind of things are free. So, you know, if you want to go get cocktails in the city or... you know, go out for dinner at a lovely restaurant. I don't know, you know, go to all those snazzy sushi places. And yes, we're going to be spending shitloads of money. But Dolly and I don't really do that unless someone else is picking up the bill.
Yeah.
So save the cocktails for once a month.
But also, that's the other thing that I always used to do when I was skint, is that I always wanted to do luxurious things but had no money. And there is a backdoor route. You can go to Claridge's and have one cocktail that costs £13 or £15 and make that last... for 3 hours.
And eat you before.
Exactly. You can go
I became the queen of eating before when I interned.
Yeah, I used to do that. Or you can go to, even if you want to treat, you know, even if you and your friend are celebrating a birthday or whatever, you can look up really fancy restaurants. Most Michelin-style restaurants do a weekday lunch special that's like £30. So you could go do that. You can go to Liberty and you can look at all the lovely clothes and try them on. Then just buy a lovely, luxurious soap for £4.
Also, cook your own food. I can't stress that enough. I waste money on, you know, not cooking my own lunches, not eating at home. You know, you can make a chicken salad or pasta for, I don't know, £3, or if it's pasta, probably £1. But also, do you know what? Google, because there will be so many amazing financial advice forums and bureaus, people like you who have just moved to the city. There's that Evening Standard writer called Lucy something who writes a lot about finances. Can you remember her surname?
I can't remember her surname.
She's a really well-known journalist. I think she's about our age and she's written sort of 4 books. But if you Google, you know, budget saving tips London, budget student, young person, anything around like that, there is a wealth of information out there, because I'm always really pleasantly surprised by the help that does actually exist in stuff like that, in helping you with your money.
And but most people in London are skint as well. You know, other than the oligarchs, most of us are skint. So we're all just trying to get by.
But we do quite like a cocktail. But you know what? We're bloody 30. It's taken long enough. Well, I am. Obviously, Dolly's not. I think it's weird. She shouldn't be allowed cocktails yet. She's too young. Thank you very much to Wise Buddha Studios for letting us hang out and record. Both of us are really hot. Do I look as hot as you look? You're so pink.
Am I?
Yes,
feel really
I know.
Hot.
It's quite hot in the studio.
You know, it's because the aircon's not working today. We did get an email from the studio.
You got an email because you booked
it. Sorry, I didn't
pass it on. Thank you, Wise Buddha, for letting me eat all your sweets. I ate 7 while here, and as usual, I'm going away feeling sick and sticky and thirsty. Who else do we need to thank? Lauren Benstead for our sexy jingle.
For the funky tunes.
Don't forget to tweet us at The High Low Show, and you can email us thehighlowshow@gmail.com. We will be back next week. Sadly, we're not having another holiday.
We'll see you next week.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.